Thanks for tuning in for the January 21st podcast. This week's featured interview highlights an article on longitudinal change in regional brain volumes with exposure to repetitive head impacts. For our What's Trending feature of the week, you'll hear an interview on infant colic and episodic syndromes.
Hi, this is Jeff Ratliff with the Neurology Podcast. Welcome to this week's featured article interview. In this week's interview, we're welcoming Dr. Charlie Burnick from Cleveland Clinic in Las Vegas to discuss his article in the latest issue of Neurology. His article is titled Longitudinal Change in Regional Brain Volumes with Exposure to Repetitive Head Impacts. Longtime listeners will recognize that we've discussed the ongoing search for biomarkers and the clinical sequelae of repeated head trauma in prior episodes of the podcast as far back as 2011. There's a delayed recall episode from September of 2017 that pulls together a number of different interviews. In today's interview, we want to circle back to this concept in response to this recent publication where Charlie and his collaborators studied the rate of brain volume changes on MRI in a cohort of boxers and mixed martial arts fighters compared to match controls. Charlie, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thanks, Jeff. It's a pleasure to be here.
So for a little bit of background, coming into the study, what did we know about using MRI to study the sequelae of repetitive head impacts?
We've known actually a long time that a marker on MRI and actually even CT scan, the cavum septum pellucidum, was clearly related to exposure to head trauma, and it's still a very useful sign even now. But we didn't really know much more about longitudinal changes, microstructural changes, until I think, you know, the more recent decade. And there's plenty of reports on DTI changes on MRI scan and resting state connectivity changes on MRI. But because those techniques are not really standardized now, I don't know how applicable they really are. We looked at regional MRI volumes because there are commercial techniques that can look at this. And we had some preliminary evidence in our data set to suggest that actually looking at specific volumes in the brain may be a useful technique or biomarker in people who've been exposed to repetitive head trauma.
And so it sounds like certainly some other techniques that we've used to look at sequelae of this, but you're looking at brain volumes through technology we have available pretty commonly today. So tell me a little bit about what you did. Who did you look at? What were some of the salient take-home results from what you guys found?
Yes, so we analyzed data that came from a study called the Professional Fighters Brain Health Study. So this is a longitudinal study of professional fighters, so boxers, mixed martial arts fighters, both active and retired, who've been followed on an annual basis, some up to 8 years so far. And at each annual visit, they do get MRI imaging, which is then processed, and we come up with regional volumes. In looking at this cohort over time, we came up with average yearly change of various regional volumes. And what we found was that in active fighters, you can actually detect, at least at a group level, that there is a measurable decline in thalamic volume, corpus callosum volume, whereas in the retired fighters, it was not that. It was actually changes seen mainly in the amygdala and hippocampus. And this is, again, compared to controls who have not been exposed to head trauma. So it's kind of an interesting result in that it may mean that we're actually picking up two different processes. One involving active fighters where we're seeing maybe the sequela of active injury to axonal elements and maybe a dying back phenomena in these deep brain regions. Whereas in the retired fighters, it's possible we may be looking at a neurodegenerative process because, for example, in CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, the main pathology over time is in the frontal and then temporal regions, particularly as CTE advances. So these findings need to be obviously replicated in other populations and so on and so forth, but I think it gives us perhaps some clue of what may be going on an ongoing basis.
Is there a correlation between the regions anatomically that we see affected in CTE and the regions that are affected on the MRIs in your retired fighters?
Absolutely. Even in CTE, you can see changes in deep structures, but the kind of bulk of pathology in CTE is temporal, frontal, and the temporal regions where we're seeing the changes on longitudinal MRI scans in retired fighters. So it just implies that we may be looking at a different process in that group than in these active fighters who we're seeing actually more changes in deep brain structures.
In our search for a radiological indicator or biomarker of neurodegeneration, what are the next steps? What do we have to achieve to get something that's going to be clinically useful and clinically meaningful?
Well, I will say this. The variability, at least in studies with test-retest protocols shows there is some variability between one test and another in measuring volumes, as you might expect, but it's really not that great. In our study, we do have a measure to look at signal-to-noise ratios, and we got rid of all the scans that were really pretty crummy. So we felt pretty confident that the changes we saw are actually valid. Whether you can use commercial techniques and use different scanners to pick up the same type of changes is not clear. So the next steps would be to see, in real world, are there protocols or methods that could actually reduce that variability in a real-life situation? Because, again, many studies you see published are coming from single centers, and yeah, they're the same scanner, and that's true. You're absolutely right. It may not apply to, you know, general clinical practice.
In the study you did, you also looked at some serum biomarkers looking at plasma tau and neurofilament light concentrations. What do we know about the utility or the future utility of blood tests versus imaging tests to help monitor or predict some of the downstream pathological changes in the brain from repetitive head impacts? Do you think one may be more useful than the other, or do you speculate that maybe we're going to end up using a combination of both serum and radiological measurements?
Yeah, I'm pretty convinced it's unlikely we'll have just one measure that's reliable. And I think the more, within reason, the more measures that we have that we can actually combine to come up with a solid finding is likely the way it's going to go. The neurofilament light is released from axons that are injured. So we did find that those individuals who had higher levels of neurofilament light were more likely to have the volume changes that we saw, the decline in volume, which kind of makes sense. As we look at this further, and I think, again, it has to be replicated in other populations and so on, probably some combination of these various measures would probably be the most helpful indicator of certainly acute injury and then perhaps subsequently longitudinal changes. Keep in mind that the neurofilament light didn't seem to have an effect in the retired fighters, again, suggesting that maybe it's just a totally different process that we're seeing in that group compared to the active fighters that are being actively concussed.
The two groups, or at least the active fighters and the retired fighters that you looked at, we touched on how the patterns of volume loss were different in one group to the other. Is there, and this may be speculation, but is there any way to look in the active fighters and start to see signs of that transition? Maybe some of the volume loss is a function of being an active fighter and still sustaining these repetitive head impacts. But then does that transition to maybe this post-retirement neurodegenerative process that you may be seeing some sequelae of in the retired fighters?
Yeah, that's a key point. And that's exactly what we hope over time to learn in this project. So far, we do have some fighters who have made that transition within the study period that we're following them, but probably not really enough to make much of. But I think that's going to be a crucial point is, are any of these features that we're seeing, or can we determine features that will predict which of those active fighters are at highest risk of subsequent progressive neurodegenerative disease? And that will be really, I think, a critical point in the field if we can determine that and come up with some biomarkers to predict that.
Excellent. I want to encourage all of our listeners to go check out Charlie's article in this week's issue of Neurology. Again, the article is titled Longitudinal Change in Regional Brain Volumes with Exposure to Repetitive Head Impacts. Thanks again for joining us, Charlie.
Thank you, Jeff. Appreciate it.
Welcome, everyone, to Neurology Podcast. I'm Dr. Tisha Monteith from the University of Miami. Today's lesson of the week is on episodic syndromes that may be associated with migraine and infant colic. We have the pleasure of interviewing Dr. Amy Gelfand. Amy is an associate professor of neurology at the University of California, San Francisco. She's a child neurologist and director of the Pediatric Headache Clinic at the UCSF. Amy, thank you for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
I feel like I've seen you progress from when you first started doing some of this research to now on stage getting all these awards related to your work in infant colic.
Yeah, it's been a really interesting progression and process.
Can you tell the listeners what are the most important clinical considerations that they should know about the episodic syndromes that may be associated with migraine?
Well, I'll start with the one that affects youngest children, which is infant colic, the one that I've researched the most. All babies cry, but colicky babies cry more. So infant colic means that it's a baby who's excessively crying and often inconsolably crying. And infant crying takes a really interesting developmental progression. I think it's historically been understudied and maybe thought of as being more related to what the babies are eating. But babies don't cry so much when they're first born. Their crying ramps up over the first few weeks of life and peaks around 5 or 6 weeks of life and then tapers down so that they're crying much less by about 3 months of life. And what we found in now 2 studies is that mothers with migraine are more likely to have infants with colic. And what I think is going on there is that we know that migraine is a genetic disorder, it's inherited, and that people who have migraine are more sensitive to stimuli, whether those are external stimuli or internal stimuli. And they're more sensitive to stimuli both during a migraine attack and in between attacks. And so I think what's happening is that babies who are colicky are ones who have inherited these migraine genes from a parent, and their brains are wired up to be more sensitive to stimuli, those stimuli that they encounter when they are born and that they increasingly perceive over the first few weeks of life as their perceptual abilities ramp up quite quickly, and that they maybe are overwhelmed perhaps by all of that stimuli and express that through colicky crying that tends to happen at the end of the day. So infant colic may be an early life marker that somebody has a predisposition toward migraine, that they're wired up to be a bit more sensitive than somebody else. And then children can go from one of these episodic syndromes to another as they grow and develop. So infant colic is the one that affects the youngest babies, but then older infants can have this condition called benign paroxysmal torticollis, which starts around age 4 to 6 months, and they will have periodic episodes of head tilt accompanied by pallor, irritability, fussiness, nausea, sometimes vomiting. If they're old enough to crawl or walk during the attacks, you can also sometimes see ataxia, and they can have gross motor delay or loss of skills during those attacks because presumably it's hard to balance when this is happening. And then they usually outgrow that after a few years. And now progressing to slightly older children, preschoolers can have an episodic syndrome called benign paroxysmal vertigo, where out of the blue, they will suddenly look scared or dizzy and maybe have even nystagmus. And you have to think about epilepsy on your differential, but often it will just last for a few minutes and then they'll go back to being totally fine. Then when you get more into school age kids, like 5 or 6 year old children, they can have one of 2 things that together come under this label of recurrent gastrointestinal disturbance, and those are abdominal migraine or cyclic vomiting syndrome. Abdominal migraine is characterized by episodes of abdominal pain that tends to be periumbilical and dull or kind of just sore, and they might have nausea and they don't want to eat. And I've heard several kids actually describe visual aura occurring with those episodes, which is interesting. And then that will go for a number of hours or a couple of days, and then they'll be fine until the next one. Or cyclic vomiting syndrome, which tends, in my experience, to start out of sleep in the middle of the night, around 2 or 3 in the morning. They wake up with a ton of vomiting, nausea, sometimes vertigo, and that goes for a number of hours. And then they're fine in between attacks, but they have some sort of periodicity to their attacks. And these kids who get abdominal migraine and cyclic vomiting syndrome, it's interesting to follow them over time, because when I meet them and they're 6 or 7 years old and having abdominal migraine, then as they start to get around 9 or 10 years old, they'll start to say that their head hurts during the attack. And it's interesting where they sort of have belly and head pain at the same time. And then let's say maybe by the time they're 12 years old, it's just the head that they're complaining of when they're getting an attack. And so you can sort of watch it evolve from abdominal migraine into what we all would recognize as migraine in an adult. And it's interesting to watch that happen in the developing person.
That's really interesting. And so it sounds like, at least for infant colic, you've mentioned several characteristics very similar of migraine, that there's a genetic driver, that it's a state of hypersensitivity, and you also mentioned a bit of a perceptual disorder. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, at least in terms of what I would hypothesize is going on, we haven't had a way to objectively measure yet what these babies' level of sensitivity is, but I think that's kind of the next step in research, is trying to find a way to measure how sensitive they are to light, how sensitive they are to sound, those types of things.
And do we know how common the episodic syndromes are in adults with migraine? Because the terminology has changed.
Right, exactly. So it used to be called childhood periodic syndrome, but now it's called episodic syndrome that may be associated with migraine, in recognition that these episodes can happen in adults and not just in children. And where that's really seen, I think, most is in abdominal migraine and cyclic vomiting syndrome. infant colic is indeed limited to babies. And benign paroxysmal torticollis is really little ones too. Benign paroxysmal vertigo to a certain extent, kids too, but that one can go a little bit older. But abdominal migraine and cyclic vomiting syndrome are the ones that can be seen in adults. And I think the prevalence is not particularly well studied for either of those. I would say that one of the things for cyclic vomiting syndrome that is interesting and deserves further research and attention is how it is either distinct from the similar entity called cannabinoid hyperemesis syndrome versus an extension of it, or if frequent use of cannabis is maybe a way to invoke a receptor pattern in the brain that is similar to what people with primary cyclic vomiting syndrome might have to start with. And so as people are studying more, and with cannabis legalization being more widespread in the United States, I think we may need to look at that more and try to determine whether they're really distinct entities or a spectrum with some overlap.
Absolutely. So what are some ways to treat patients with infant colic and then also the episodic syndromes?
So for infant colic, these are such young babies that I think we really want to think about safety first, of course, and behavioral interventions, I think, are the most logical thing to do at this point. And so if the baby's really fussy and crying at the end of the day, trying to do some of the things that we would do to help a child with migraine, turn down the light, turn down the sound, limit the number of people in the room, try not to have strong smells around. And I think that at this point would be the main treatment intervention, and reassurance that colic is a time-limited phenomenon. The babies will outgrow it. And so families may feel at the end of their rope when they're in the moment there, but education and reassurance that it is something that will pass. For benign paroxysmal torticollis, there's an interesting abstract that was presented by Caitlin Green last year at the Academy, where she interviewed a number of families who have children with this disorder. And what they are most interested in is clinicians knowing about the disorder. It's rare, and it's really probably under-recognized by pediatricians and clinicians who care for children. And so the families really would like to see us better able to recognize it and have less diagnostic delay and mystery around it. They don't necessarily want to treat their children during the episodes in general, though for those kids with benign paroxysmal torticollis who vomit during their episodes, certainly some expressed interest in antiemetic therapy for that. Benign paroxysmal vertigo is so quick. It's usually just on the order of a couple of minutes that, again, there I think treatment is around reassurance and explanation about what the condition is rather than any kind of specific acute therapy. For abdominal migraine and cyclic vomiting syndrome, you know, I personally treat them as I would migraine in other kids. And if it's really frequent, I think about migraine preventive treatment. And for acute treatment, I think about NSAIDs and triptans. And I think we certainly need more or any randomized placebo-controlled trials. There's a small one for abdominal migraine for pazodafen, which is similar to cyproheptadine, and that was effective. But we really need more trials and research for these groups of kids. But with the current state of things, I treat them as I would a child with migraine headache.
Well, you are so thorough. I really enjoyed this conversation, and I hope to have you back. We need more people out in the field that are treating pediatric migraine.
Yeah, I guess that is a good and important final thought. Migraine in children and adolescents is incredibly common. By age 10, the prevalence of migraine is 5% in kids. That means that by fourth grade, on average, there's a child with migraine in every single classroom. So it's really a common disorder, and I think it is still underdiagnosed and underrecognized. And the amount of disability, missed school, missed activities, missed portions of childhood and adolescence that migraine causes is really substantial, and we desperately need more research in this area.
My thoughts exactly. Amy, thank you so much for saying yes to this interview.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is Bob Gross again. Please check out this week's journal, which features an interesting article on the association of CD14 with incident dementia and markers of brain aging and injury, and an article on racial and ethnic disparities and the risk of intracerebral hemorrhage recurrence. And don't forget to check out Neurology's three subspecialty journals, Neurology Genetics, Neurology Neuroimmunology and Neuroinflammation, and Neurology Clinical Practice, as well as our mini-sites on Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion, Global Neurology, and Innovations in Care Delivery. Thank you again for listening, and have a great week.
The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.